Miami-Dade schools have a start date for in-person classes. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It was a marathon two-day meeting where hundreds of community members left messages and school board members engaged in heated debate.
We had 6 months to be able to answer the questions that we're having now, not convinced that we have reached that point.
They picked October 14th, but many questions still remain for teachers, parents, and faculty alike. Plus, President Trump is headed to Florida later this week for a campaign rally in Jacksonville and a visit to Miami. Can he take the Sunshine State again in 2020? Finally, a new survey finds a majority of millennials and Gen Zers didn't know how many people were killed during the Holocaust. A look at how Florida teaches the subject and the role Jewish students play in teaching their peers. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Parents and caregivers in Miami-Dade, there's now a scheduled date to have students back in the classroom. Following a marathon school board meeting lasting 2 days, including 18 hours of public comment, school board members agreed to resume in-person classes on October 14th. Now, you may have heard some of that meeting on the station. Miami-Dade Public Schools is WLRN's broadcast license holder, but has no editorial control over our content. Parents have the option to send their children back into the classroom. Teachers will need to make some difficult decisions in the coming weeks. WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman joins us now. Jessica, great to have you.
Thanks, Lewis.
You listened to a lot of the two-day school board meeting, which, by the way, I applaud you for that. What did you hear from parents and teachers about their desires and their concerns about what's, reopening?
Well, there are certainly parents who feel really overwhelmed with the prospect of a long-term, even longer-term than it has already been, situation where they have to be home helping their kids navigate the online learning system while also, juggling their own work responsibilities. So there are definitely those out there that want their kids back in school. And also, they're concerned about their students, not only the quality of their learning, but also their socialization and the opportunities for them to be able to interact with their peers. But overwhelmingly, the comments were people who were concerned that schools were not ready to reopen and not ready in terms of the safety protocols that need to be in place in order to make sure that the coronavirus does not continue to spread, in schools. And one of the big concerns from teachers was about how to go about applying for accommodations if they have an underlying condition that would put them at risk of severe illness or death from COVID-19, or if they are a caregiver for someone in that position. And the district has basically said there are processes that they can use to apply for accommodations either through the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a federal law, or the, I believe it's Family and Medical Leave Act, which is another federal law. So basically those two options provide different types of leave of absence or accommodations that teachers can apply for. But of course, it's not guaranteed that they're going to get it.
Yeah. The start date is 2 weeks later than what Superintendent Carvalho wanted. He received a lot of pushback from school board members and the teachers union about that plan, including school board chair Perla Tabaris Hantman. Here's what she said.
We had six entire months to be able to answer the questions that we're having now, to be able to meet with medical experts. All this, we had 6 months. It's half a year that we had to be able to be prepared. And I'm just not convinced that we have reached that point.
Jessica, what were the other concerns raised?
Well, like you heard from school board chair Hantman, some of the other school board members had similar comments, basically just not being satisfied with the preparations that have been in place. And I think it's important to think about this conversation in the context of everything that's happened over the last few weeks. The school district opened with remote learning, but instead of using the same online tools that they had used in the spring, like Microsoft Teams and Zoom, they were using this new platform called My School Online that was provided by a for-profit company called K-12. And a combination of software problems as well as cyber attacks made the first few days of online remote learning in Miami-Dade County a complete disaster. Teachers and students and parents couldn't get in, or they would lose access to the online programming. And the school board eventually decided to get rid of that for-profit company, K-12, and to move forward. So I think if you think about like the school board members already being frustrated with the school district administration, with Superintendent Alberto Carvalho, that process went so badly, I think they don't want to take a chance of reopening for in-person classes and having it go badly. So they listened to the teachers and parents who said, we're not ready, we need more time.
Yeah. Now, parents are going to have the option. They can send their kid back into the classroom, or they can continue virtual learning. But do we have any idea what that in-person schooling is going to look like? I mean, I'm picturing, is a teacher going to be in a classroom teaching some students there and others online at the same time?
So no, the Miami-Dade County School District and the teachers union came to an agreement previously about what it would look like when in-person classes started again. And they their plan is for no what they call dual modality. So there won't be a situation where there's a teacher who's having to deal with the kids on Zoom and the kids in her classroom at the same time. There will be teachers who are teaching kids on Zoom and teachers who are teaching kids in the classroom.
Is there agreement right now? I mean, did they come to an agreement? Is everybody on board with this? Or is there any concern that you might see what's up in Palm Beach County, where there are lawsuits now against the district?
I don't get the sense that we're headed toward lawsuits in Miami-Dade, especially because the school board did decide to push this back a little bit to give more time for preparation. Anything could change in the next couple of weeks. But, you know, yesterday after the school board made that decision, the union, United Teachers of Dade, put out a statement saying, you know, basically that they were grateful that the school district listened, that the school board listened to teachers' concerns, and that there would be more time now to make sure that all the safety protocols are in place. So it looks right now like everyone's getting along. But again, we'll see.
All of this is happening in Miami-Dade. You were also following the school board meeting in Broward. Superintendent Robert Runcie wanted to start classes sometime between October 5th and the 12th. Also met resistance. Where do things stand there?
Yeah, so yesterday, and you know, you mentioned before that I watched a lot of the virtual meeting in Miami-Dade. Yesterday, I actually had two computers in front of me, one with the Miami-Dade meeting and one with the Broward meeting.
Oh my God.
And I was going back and forth, like muting one of them. Okay, what are they saying? Then muting the other one. Okay, where are they now? But Broward is a little bit farther behind Dade in making this decision. They didn't vote yesterday. The school board yesterday was having a workshop basically to hear Superintendent Runcie's plan about what you know, in-person classes in Broward County would look like. And then they plan to make the decision on the date for reopening at the next school board meeting, although the representatives of the school district didn't specify when that would be. It could be next Tuesday, it could be later, or they might schedule something that we don't already know is in the works. But anyway, they'll make the decision in the next week or so, probably about when. And they, from their conversation yesterday, it sounded like they were talking about October 16th. So similar to Dade, they're thinking about a mid-October reopening.
Yeah, just want to mention, by the way, that Superintendent Runcie will be on the Florida Roundup on Friday, so he'll probably be asking these questions and dealing with all of that and maybe giving us an update at that time. Now, you know, we had Broward Teachers Union President Anna Fusco on the program recently. She expressed concerns about the district's plans. Did the school board members or the superintendent address those concerns about getting the classrooms ready and the protocols for teachers if they get sick?
Well, again, I think the fact that the school board members and they haven't made a final decision but are discussing a mid-October reopening is a win for the Broward Teachers Union, just like it was a win for United Teachers of Dade that indeed they decided to go with October 14th, because it does give more time for the school district to answer the questions and meet the needs of teachers. You know, a lot of the questions that they're asking are, you know, how many students are going to be in a classroom at the same time? How much space is there going to be between their desks? You know, is there a guarantee that, you know, any air quality or airflow problems have been taken care of? You know, because obviously we know that that COVID-19 can spread through the air through respiratory particles when people are talking, and that poor air ventilation could make that potential spread worse. So I think there's enough time there for those questions to get answered. But again, we'll see what happens over the next few weeks. Like, this whole situation has been so fluid that things change from one day to the next.
Yes, they do. You know, let me finish with this. Miami-Dade and Broward, the biggest school districts in the state, the only districts that have not yet reopened their doors to in-person classes. Is there pressure from the state to reopen? I mean, could their finances be jeopardized for this?
So I don't know exactly the answer to that, but here's what I know. The State Department of Education required school districts to get their approval for a reopening plan. And the Broward plan said that they expected to go back into in-person schooling for the second quarter of the school year, which for them starts October 16th. So if they go back October 16th, they'll be right in line with the plan that they had approved from the Department of Education. Miami-Dade, however, their plan that was approved said, if local health conditions allow, we'll be back in classrooms October 5th, which was what Superintendent Alberto Carvalho was shooting for in his original plan. And so we don't really have the answer yet as to whether that's going to be, you know, that's going to fly with DOE. They might turn around and say, well, no, the gating criteria regarding the health conditions have been mostly met. We want to see you go into classrooms sooner. I did reach out to the Department of Education yesterday and I didn't get a response to that question. So we'll see.
We'll see, and we'll keep you updated as the information is made available. Again, WLRN's education reporter, Jessica Bateman. Jess, thanks so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still to come, can the Trump campaign retake Florida in 2020? We'll find out. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. President Trump will be back in Florida this week, first for a campaign stop in Jacksonville on Thursday, and then down to Miami on Friday. He may meet with Barbara Lagoa, the former Miami-Dade Circuit Court judge who's now in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta. Lagoa is reportedly on President Trump's short list to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, the Supreme Court, the economy, and law enforcement, all key issues for the Trump campaign strategy to try to retake the Sunshine State. Now, yesterday, Governor Ron DeSantis announced a new proposal to stiffen penalties on protesters and take state aid from local governments that defund their police departments. Joe Gruters is the chairman of the Florida GOP, a representative for President Trump's reelection campaign, and a state senator from Sarasota County. Senator Gruters, always a pleasure. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on today. Really appreciate it.
By the way, just wanted to mention, we did hear from former Florida Senator Bill Nelson with the Biden campaign last week. You can hear that interview at WLRN.org. Senator Gruters, I wanted to start with the recent news from the governor. He brought out his proposal, the Combating Violence, Disorder, and Looting in Law Enforcement Protection Act. It includes a number of provisions that would bring felony charges to protesters if property is damaged or roadways are blocked. It would block future employment in the state government, if you are arrested. The governor wants the legislature to convene a special session in November and bring this forward. If it is, would you support it?
I would certainly support it. I think this is about safety and security, and what you've seen in other areas is lawlessness. And listen, we want to make sure we protect the rights of protesters and individuals to go out there and make their case known. But it's when they resort to violence, to rioting, to burning things up, tearing things down, and especially when they attack our law enforcement officers and first responders, Certainly, they should be held to a higher level. And what we're seeing in a lot of these left-leaning cities where this rioting is going on is a lot of these people are from out of state, and that's one of the provisions in the bill that I like is, you know, there's paid actors to try to incite violence and chaos in communities. And, you know, whether you're a small business owner or you just live in a community, the last thing you want to have or see is your community disrupted by out-of-towners who have really no business protesting in your community other than trying to pick a fight. And certainly our law enforcement has gone through a lot. This is about standing up and backing them and their efforts.
There's one part of it I wanted to ask you about. We heard from a number of legal experts and the head of the ACLU of Florida yesterday that raised concerns about this aspect. One key piece of it that says, quote, a driver is not liable for injury or death caused if fleeing for safety from a mob. Are you concerned for an individual's safety? I mean, regardless of their political affiliation or where they stand, that they're putting basically anybody with the ability to do this, they can harm or kill somebody.
Well, listen, you have to have fear, and it's about the motorist's safety as well. What we should all do is obey the laws. You know, if you want to protest, get a permit, do it correctly, and don't block highways. I mean, it just seems like it's common sense. When you block highways and disrupt things like that, you prevent first responders from getting to and from real issues and in real crisis. And it's unfortunate that you actually have to spell that out, because you would think it'd be common sense that don't go out in the middle of the road and hold up a sign. You know, do it from the sidewalk and wave like normal people. I'm actually glad they have it in there, because they think people need to follow the laws. And like I said, a lot of times this is driven by out-of-state groups with paid actors to incite violence and to really create chaos in communities. And this is, I keep on going back to the safety and security of our communities. That's the primary job of government. And we have to make sure we allow law enforcement to do their job and to be able to protect us in a way that we all can feel safe.
But, you know, coming back to this idea, though, again, I mean, how do you write this law? So that, because look, what if you say, for example, you have a rally of Trump supporters and somebody says, I felt threatened, and then you just started driving through them? I mean, how do you have it in the law to make sure
that... I don't care if they're Trump supporters or Biden supporters or supporters of some other cause. They shouldn't be protesting by blocking the road. I mean, common sense would tell you that if you walk out into the street, there's a chance you're going to get hit. That's why we have crosswalks and everything else. The problem with our entire system right now is we have a lack of respect of authority overall. And if people follow the rules and laws and respect authority when they tell you to do something, you know, we'd have a lot less issues. And it's a
You had mentioned a couple of times, by the way, you know, when you have out-of-state actors. Do we have any proof that there were any out-of-state actors here in Florida during the protests?
No, this is happening when they're arresting. A lot of the protests in Florida, I think because of our leadership of our state, have not turned to violence, and we haven't seen the burning and the rioting and the attacks on our law enforcement officials. But we have seen across the other states, in certainly these left-leaning cities and in these leftist communities where they're governed by that, is you're seeing the out-of-town actors. And they have proven that. I think in some cases, the over 50% of them that are arrested are from, in fact, out of state. And certainly, when you talk to people in the community, even if they're protesting, I think a lot of them would prefer that it remain peaceful, and they're trying to prove a point. They're not trying to tear things down, disrupt local businesses by smashing in and having people loot and riot and burn things down.
All right. I don't have any way to back up that statistic that you're bringing up, but, you know, because I don't have that information in front of me. But, you know, we heard from the ACLU of Florida again yesterday. They point out there are already laws pertaining to violence and looting. Are the laws in place not sufficient?
Well, certainly, I think we could certainly make them stronger. And that's why you're seeing this being proposed. I applaud the governor for his efforts to try to make sure that we can continue to keep our communities even safer. I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the future? I mean, it's to me, it's terrible to watch the news at night and to see these these lawbreakers out there doing what they're doing. And it's a and whatever tools and resources we can give our local law enforcement officers to help them do their job to keep our community safe, I'm all for it.
So this goes to one of the campaign promises for the President Trump. It's about law and order. But these protests started because of the issue of social justice and systemic racism found in some of our institutions. Do you believe this is a fundamental problem that needs to be addressed?
I'm all for there's always going to be times where protesting is the best avenue for people who feel like their rights are being violated. But what we can't accept is lawbreakers taking over these groups and then burning things down, tearing down statues, and attacking law enforcement officials. And that's where this bill really goes into effect. I mean, it's a protest all you want, but do it the legal way, do it the right way, and don't start fights with our officers. Don't throw bricks at them. Don't throw the projectiles at them. What some of the things that are happening across this country should never happen. And it all goes back down to respect. Like I said, respect for authority that I think is missing, across this country. And hopefully we could learn how to all be civil. And at the same time, yes, the people that have issues and that for the social justice cause, I hope they can. But they want to protest. I hope they continue to protest and not have it hijacked by some of these far left groups. And listen, we've allowed it to happen. Some of these, but usually it's in these left leaning cities. You're right; it's not happening in Florida because we have conservative leadership, and we would put it down right away. But in the look at what's happening in Portland, it's over 100 days, and certainly that they've had their time, and it's certain businesses haven't been able to.
Well, let me come back because you had said that again you want these groups to have the ability to speak and protest. But coming back to the question though, do you think that their message is there is systemic racism that needs to be dealt with? Do you think there is?
Listen, I think if they feel like they have the right to protest, or if they want to protest, by all means, go ahead. Are there bad apples in every organization? Yes. Is law enforcement overall good and do the best job they can and filled with people that want to help and is the last line of defense and is your best friend when you need them? Yes, I do think so. But we got to continue to root out any type of bad apples. And the one thing that when I was a kid, we were taught about stereotypes, right? Stereotypes are bad. You can't blame one thing happens. You can't blame the whole population as a result of it. That's what it seems like is happening here. We're going back into where we're stereotyping all cops as being bad, all the certain demographics as being bad or evil, and it's not. We have to treat each other with respect, and certainly we could do that by, the lack of God in our classrooms and the lack of any type of faith and has certainly contributed to it. But certainly, if nothing else, basic respect for other human beings will go a long way in solving this crisis.
Again, I'm talking with Chairman of the Florida GOP and State Senator Joe Gruters. We've been talking about Governor DeSantis' recent proposal, focus on protest and funding of police in Florida. But we're also talking about President Trump's strategy for trying to re-win the Sunshine State in November. So Senator Gruters, Florida, again, a tight race for the presidency. Former VP Joe Biden barely holding a 1% lead in many polls. There is one poll from the Washington Post and ABC News released yesterday. President Trump now 4 points ahead. Trump won in 2016, not by a lot, but Florida's always very, very close. What's the strategy for securing Florida? Is it about regions? Are you looking at regions?
Well, certainly the entire, Florida is such a massive state. We almost have 4 or 5 states in different areas. But I will tell you that that we think that, we're glad that the poll today by the Washington Post said that we were up by a couple of points. We think we're going to win the state. We're literally have been a well-oiled machine firing all cylinders for almost throughout the entire year. Because this is not a persuasion campaign anymore. This is about a turnout campaign. And the Democrats and Bill Nelson may have talked to you last week about the advantage the Democrats think they have because they have a 700,000 of absentee ballot advantage. But in reality, since November of 2016, we have 150,000 net Republican advantage. And when you look at the 2018 cycle where we had two races at the top of the ticket at 11,000 and 33,000 for the governor and U.S. Senate race, I would rather have net new voters than just moving when my voters are going to vote. We have 190 staffers on the ground. We've made over 17 million voter contacts. We've had, I think, almost 1.7 million door knocks. And like I said, we are our ground game is solid. You mentioned the fact that the president's coming to Jacksonville, then Miami. Expect to see a lot more visits because Florida, you're right, Florida's the big prize. We're a purple state. But I think that we have, because of our ground forces and everything we're doing, because when you look at what the other side is doing, they have no ground game. They're doing virtual type things, which helps, but they're not doing the ground hand-to-hand combat, and we're absolutely demolishing the Democrats when it comes to our basic core functions as a campaign.
Let's bring up some of the issues that obviously are going to be raised during this campaign, have been raised. Former Vice President Biden and his supporters have continued to go after President Trump's response to the pandemic. How is the Florida GOP talking about the president's COVID response? Again, remember, we've now hit 200,000 dead, 14,000 in the state dead because of this. How do you respond to that?
Well, listen, nobody could have ever predicted the pandemic to happen. I think the president's response of shutting down travel from China early on was the right move, then stopping it from other international sources where they had major issues.
Do you think he stopped it early enough? Did he jump on it early enough? Because that's a criticism.
Yes. Well, think about it. Joe Biden didn't want him to stop it at all. He actually called Donald Trump a xenophobe for stopping those flights. That's the whole problem. The Democrats have no solutions. All they want to do is attack, where Donald Trump actually created action. Not only that, think about the Operation Warp Speed the program that the president immediately put in place, where we're trying to fast track some of these vaccines. We're lucky we live in America. We have some of the best healthcare minds in the world. They've all been working aggressively at trying to go after some of these solution, both for treatments and with vaccine. And that's directly attributable to the president. And then on top of that, don't forget, we had the big issue at the beginning in some of these other countries is they didn't have the ventilators in place and people were dying in the hospitals by not having access to equipment. In America, because of the direct result of what the president did with his actions and pushing people, we have ventilators. Nobody has been denied. Nobody's been sitting in the hallway denied a ventilator. And so for that, he deserves a lot of credit.
I had time for one more question, and I got to it at the intro, so I have to ask, because the president may be speaking with a potential Supreme Court justice nominee. Who do you think he should pick?
Listen, I think that I want a constitutionalist who's going to follow the law and not try to legislate from the bench. And I think that if you talk to people throughout the country, whether or not Judge Lagoa is going to be picked or not, or Judge Barrett, to me, it's irrelevant. We need somebody who will follow the Constitution, that will be a solid conservative, that will do the right thing and not try to legislate from the bench. And I think what the president has done is released his list, so there's no surprises. Everybody knows who's on that list.
And what do you think
Biden should? Joe Biden should release his list, but he won't because he's scared that the American public will reject it.
What do you think about the argument that the Democrats make that you didn't give President Obama the ability to pick somebody in an election year? Why pick somebody in an election year? Why not wait till after the election?
President Obama said it right. Elections have consequences. We have the presidency. We have the Senate. There's in numerous cases, I think 29 other cases on election year where that has happened, where the nominees have been not only nominated by the president, but confirmed by the Senate. But like I said, President Obama himself said elections have consequences. In 2018, when Kavanaugh was up, that was, if you remember, that was right before the election, and the American people returned the Senate back to Republican hands, I think as a direct result of the Kavanaugh hearing and everything that surrounded it. And I think that they want, the American public overall wants the president to act, and they want the president to appoint somebody on his list who he has already made public so everybody knows, so there's no surprises.
He is State Senator Joe Gruters, chairman of the Florida GOP. Senator Gruters, always a pleasure. Thank you for the time.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Again, President Trump will be back in Florida later this week with a scheduled visit to Miami on Friday. You'll be here, able to hear analysis of Judge Barbara Lagoa on our program tomorrow. Well, still to come, the results of a new survey about Floridians' knowledge of the Holocaust may surprise you. It isn't good. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A new survey found that a majority of American young adults lack basic knowledge about the Holocaust. 23% of millennials and Gen Z adults believe the Holocaust was a myth or had been exaggerated. Florida was among the lowest scoring states. That's despite it being one of the first in the country to add Holocaust education as part of the state curriculum. Earlier this year, Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill into law that will make that education uniform statewide. That legislation was sponsored by Democratic State Senator Lauren Book. Senator Book represents parts of Broward County, and we spoke with her earlier this week.
The new survey that came out indicates that almost two-thirds of young adults in America do not know that 6 million Jews and millions more people were killed during the Holocaust. 23% say they believe the Holocaust was a myth. Take us back to the moment you saw that story and your reaction.
Thank you for having me. And it is terrible. It is horrifying when I saw the results of this survey. You know, being Jewish myself my entire life, you know, we learned about the Holocaust. We, you know, did different days with survivors where we got to, learn from them and hear how we can stop atrocities like this from occurring. So when you hear that there are so many people across the country, but also here in our state, that don't know anything and have no real understanding of the Holocaust, it is truly horrifying. I mean, in the state of Florida, as you said, 61% of the respondents didn't know that 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust, with more than 31% believing that the death toll was fewer than 2 million. That is truly, truly, it's horrific considering, you know, I subscribe to the belief that if you forget any part of your history, you're damned to repeat it. And that is a very, very scary thought.
Florida was among the lowest scoring states when it came to the Holocaust knowledge in this age group. And yet we have the third highest Jewish population. So how do you explain that disconnect?
You know, I think it's terrible. I think, you know, when we were working on a piece of legislation last session about Holocaust education, I had the incredible opportunity to bring a survivor of Auschwitz to the Capitol. Her name was Marta Bagger, and she actually escaped Auschwitz. And what we know is they're not getting any younger. And so I think one of the things that's really important is that we engage younger people. I know that's something that we believe is so important. But, you know, when you think about the fact that in that same survey, and you're right, we were one of the lowest in the country, 50% of those respondents didn't know what Auschwitz was. It's very scary. And I don't know if it's the moving of social media and our connection in different ways. And, I don't know, but it is truly, truly horrifying.
I mean, how real is the fear? I kind of hear it in your voice that this history is being forgotten by younger generations, and it could slip away from our consciousness.
100%. You know, there's a couple of reasons why it's so horrifying to me, just from the sheer, you know, historical perspective. But Elie Wiesel had said that if you forget the Holocaust, so too does every survivor die twice. And I've spent quite a bit of time at the Holocaust Documentation Center in Hollywood. And it's an incredible place if anybody who's listening needs to go. It's run by an incredible woman who actually was born in a liberation camp. And her name is Rosita, and she's fabulous. But the day that we went there, they have dozens of people sitting, actually typing out the oral histories that they take of survivors. And one of the things that they do not do is they do not put any videos online, because Holocaust deniers attack and harm these survivors of the Holocaust. And when she's telling me this, I couldn't believe it.
You sponsored a bill that was signed by Governor Ron DeSantis earlier this year, and it mandates a uniform statewide Holocaust curriculum. What does that bill entail?
Holocaust education was being taught with no real fidelity throughout the state. In fact, on one day of testifying, we learned that some teachers and educators were using stories about the metamorphosis of butterflies as it related to Holocaust education. Not real sure what and how that related, but it was just not being unique, what was not being taught uniformly throughout the state. And so we really wanted to change that. We wanted to make sure that we weren't just learning the history of the Holocaust, dates, names of different camps, but also how something like that was able to occur in the world. Making sure that we talk about if you see a wrongdoing, stand up. Don't be a bystander. Don't let somebody else speak up for you.
So this bill moves Holocaust curriculum forward. But, I mean, Florida was the first state in the country to institute Holocaust education. That was back in 1994. Mm-hmm. We spoke with Linda Medvin. She's the director of Florida Atlantic University's Center for Holocaust and Human Rights Education. And she works directly with teachers in teaching this curriculum. And this is what she said. She explains the challenges that some teachers face.
I think that many teachers are afraid of the subject because they don't know enough about it to teach it effectively. They don't have the historical background. They may think the perception is that if you're only a Jewish teacher should be teaching the Holocaust, but it's a history course. It's not, it's history. And sometimes we get them, they're just afraid. They're afraid of the ramifications of what happens if they say something wrong in their classroom. I had a teacher at one time who, in her list of spelling words, was using Hitler. And I don't know that that's an appropriate spelling word for a first grade classroom.
So how much responsibility falls on teachers and their ability to communicate that information and know the information?
I think that that this is, one of the reasons why we wanted to relook at the curriculum itself. I understand that there is a lot that comes with Holocaust education. We hear some of this coming, and I understand that. But I do think that we wanted to make sure that there was a standard, that it was across the board, and it was something that teachers could just read from a book and sort of teach from a document. So we did take out some of that. We did take away some of that anxiety, and I understand that that exists. Not everybody is exposed to the same things at the same times in life, and I think that I do understand that, but that is no excuse. I mean, when we started working on this bill, it was also at a time where there was a principal in Palm Beach County who said they couldn't subscribe to the belief that the Holocaust was really a historical event. And so we know that clearly this is needed. And so I'm glad that we're in a place where we're going to be able to provide that to educators.
And that was William Latson. He was the principal at Spanish River High School. I'm speaking with Democratic State Senator Lauren Book. She represents parts of Broward County. A new survey indicates that almost 2/3 of young adults in America do not know that 6 million Jews were killed during the Holocaust. And Florida was among the lowest ranking states when it comes to Holocaust knowledge. Senator Book sponsored a bill that mandates a statewide Holocaust curriculum. So you've worked as a teacher. So from your experience, what kind of impact do you think this education has when it reaches kids in the classroom?
Well, I think it's all about how you do it and in developmentally appropriate ways, right? When we started talking, we talked about not being a bystander. For some of those younger kids, it's about seeing a wrong and teaching them that you see a wrongdoing and you stand up. You don't let somebody else, come up and stand up when you see something that's wrong. You say something. That is something that is a tenet of Holocaust education. You don't have to, be teaching about the atrocities at Auschwitz for kindergartners or for first graders. But as you grow developmentally, you enhance and you teach some of the history of it, how some of those things were able to happen, how people don't understand that when we were talking about the Olympics and how they were able to use propaganda to show a certain side in Germany of what was actually going on. So people didn't believe that there were ghettos coming into play. And so I think that there are different pieces of what and how you teach Holocaust education that makes it developmentally appropriate. And again, I think that's why I'm really glad that the Holocaust Task Force is looking at appropriate ways that are developmentally appropriate to teach Holocaust education across the grade span, but also that the state board is looking at that this week and we can get it underway relatively quickly.
You, as you said, you are Jewish, and I'm wondering, you know, the Holocaust, something that's discussed in Jewish families, it's a part of life, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's a piece that my grandfather always talked about. You know, my father always talked about different things that, you know, whether it was, you know, when you see something wrong, talking about how things are able to be perpetrated, how, I mean, everything, like even when it comes down to tattoos and, you know, learning about numbers and, you know, being tattooed on people's arms, like that is just something that we grew up knowing and learning about. So, you know, I think that is just a piece and a part of things that we learn, but it's a universal thing that everybody needs to be aware of.
The Anti-Defamation League reported that anti-Semitic incidents hit an all-time high last year, 56% increase in assaults. How do you fight back against that?
I think you talk about it. I think that for a long time, people didn't even really understand what anti-Semitism was. You know, and it happens all the time when people are defacing Jewish-owned businesses on the beach. That's still happening. You know, I saw a story about that, you know, just a couple of weeks ago. And I think that those are things that we all need to talk about, to stand up against, and to make sure doesn't have any place in our culture, community, or society. I think that we're in a place and in a time where we have to hold people accountable all the way across the board. You know, even when it comes down to, you know, things that people say, you know, it's a scary thing. You know, it's a scary world that we live in sometimes.
So a couple of years ago, we spoke with Anita Carl. She's a Holocaust survivor living in Miami, and she explained how she's dedicating much of her time lecturing young people on history. Here's what she said.
I lecture at schools and the colleges and in many places. I also have taken on a program that is called the March of the Living, mm-hmm. where we go, after I tell them the story, we go to Poland and we visit for 1 week all the places, the extermination camps, where 6 million of our brothers and sisters were murdered, of which 1.5 million were children. And these young seniors usually learn what I told them. They see it in person and they can connect to our past. Because if we do not look at our past, we may not have a future.
You know, you mentioned it too, finding, you know, and talking to Holocaust survivors and bringing them ahead and forward to talk to young people. But what are we going to do? Because this generation is aging out. We're losing them.
We're not going to have these survivors forever. And I, you know, they're the closest thing to, you know, something special here on earth, I believe. And so when you have the opportunity to sit across from or listen to a survivor of the Holocaust, it's, you know, it's the most important thing that you can do, to hear their stories, their family stories, to take it in, to understand it. And I think that is something that I think is so important. And, you know, for young people in this world to hear, because I think that is so important. And so I am truly, truly devastated. And one of the, again, reasons why I think it's so important we keep track of those oral histories, that we record them, and that we engage with them in that way.
That was Democratic State Senator Lauren Book. She represents parts of Broward County and again sponsored a new law that mandates a uniform statewide Holocaust curriculum. Now let's hear from a young person who dedicates much of his time to educating his peers about Jewish history. Alex Zand is the Hillel Student Board President at Florida Atlantic University. Hillel International is the largest Jewish campus organization in the world. Alex joins us now. Alex, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You were born and raised in South Florida, and I'm wondering, how do you feel about the Holocaust education that you got in public schools?
So that's a great question. I would say that throughout public schools in Parkland, where I was born and raised, we didn't have that much education on the Holocaust until I got to high school. There was an elective taught about the Holocaust where one semester was taught about the history from a history teacher, and then the other semester was taught from a literature standpoint, where we would read books such as Night by Elie Wiesel and some other books like The Diary of Anne Frank. But if you didn't take the elective, you were only taught about it in world history very briefly. Now, also, me being a Jewish student and a part of the Jewish community who's very involved, I learned about it from like a more in-depth perspective.
Yeah.
While other people and my other peers have not.
You know, you have a fascinating story. When you first got to college, you met somebody who had never met a Jewish person, right?
Correct. Yeah, a girl that lived across the hall from me, who's still one of my really good friends, she had never met a Jew before. And when she found out that I was Jewish, her first question was, I didn't know that Jews didn't have horns.
Wait a second. She actually said, you didn't have horns, and that surprised her.
And that surprised her because she had never met a Jew before. And that is the problem that we are facing nowadays. Which, I mean, it's always been very prevalent throughout history, but that was the first time that I had witnessed someone who had never met a Jew before, because growing up in South Florida, we have such a large Jewish population. And I didn't view that as an act of anti-Semitism, but just an act of misinformation and someone who just wasn't informed on Jewish culture.
All right. I got to know though, in that moment you hear something like that, what was your reaction?
I definitely took a step back. And I thought to myself, should I get upset or should I just try and educate her? And my first response was asking her what her experience was with the Jewish community and with Jewish people. And she said that she had never encountered anyone who was a part of the Jewish faith. So at that point, I just took a step back and decided to educate her. So a week later, I invited her to a Shabbat dinner. And I invited her to learn more about Jewish culture. And now she knows a lot about the Jewish community and is more than well aware that Jews do not have horns, thankfully.
That is so surprising. So, I mean, when you see this survey, you know, and so many people, young people, you know, they have these thoughts about the Holocaust, some thinking it's a myth. I mean, what was your reaction to that?
So I was looking at the statistics and that 48% can't name a single concentration camp, and that 23% of the people that were a part of the study didn't even believe that the Holocaust existed and that the Holocaust occurred. And, you know, I think the most surprising part about this is that I wasn't surprised. And even though I'm from South Florida and we have a large Jewish community, we just knowing from my friend who is from Kissimmee and other friends who aren't from areas that have large Jewish communities, I believe it. And that's, I think, the most surprising thing.
So as the Hillel Student Board President at FAU, what are the initiatives to help educate people, to spread that education, and to try to reduce those numbers and change that?
Yeah, so, I mean, as the Hillel President at FAU, we try and do everything we can. And now living in a world with COVID, it's much harder to educate as much. However, in the past, we've invited Holocaust survivors throughout Boca and South Florida to come and speak to the Jewish students and to speak to non-Jewish students especially. We invite that for students, faculty, and staff at Florida Atlantic University. It's an annual event. We partner with the school who has a Holocaust division and a department that specifically works with Holocaust survivors and with putting on events like that, trying to educate that way.
Yeah. I'd imagine you've probably seen it on Facebook or Twitter. I mean, how much is social media to blame for this misinformation?
Unfortunately, I think it has a lot to blame. I think that if one thing goes viral, then a lot of people tend to stick to it, whether it's true or not. And you see that not just with the Holocaust, but with many other topics from so many different areas. And I think that what we need to do, especially now in today's society, is to combat that on social media and to counter that with facts and by educating on social media as well as in person. Because now everyone's at home, we're all social distancing, everyone's on social media and on the internet even more, and I think that this is a very unique time where this can really benefit the world by educating people about the Holocaust.
Yeah, I mean, but do you have an example of maybe like somewhere you see somebody, or maybe it's you, doing things on social media to try to combat that, to try to show and teach and educate people?
Well, specifically about the Holocaust, that's the problem, is I haven't seen much. Now, I personally haven't seen much of people denying the Holocaust, thankfully, but this study shows otherwise. So I think that we just need to educate more and by providing facts. And instead of just saying, oh, the Holocaust occurred, there were concentration camps, teach about Auschwitz and Birkenau and teach about the 6 million Jews that died. I mean, I know in the study there was over one third thought that 2 million people or less died, and I think it was over 60% of the survey didn't know how many Jews were killed in the Holocaust. So by providing facts and providing knowledge and information, we'll combat any sort of denial.
Absolutely, it will. Alex Zand, he is the Hillel Student Board President at Florida Atlantic University. Again, Hillel International, the largest Jewish campus organization in the world. He's also running, by the way, for Parkland City Commissioner. Alex.
Yes, I am.
I really appreciate the time. Thank you for the information.
Of course. Thank you very much.
And by the way, you know what we're hearing from some of you, some of our listeners here on social media. Deb Weiss found us on Facebook, said this about 10 years ago. One of the management professors at FIU during the workplace diversity module had students write a paper on stereotypes and messages of prejudice they learn in their family environments. These were then shared anonymously with the class. The primary prejudice students learned at home was against the Jewish people, though other groups are also stereotyped in these family messages. Share your thoughts about this, and especially if you're a student in school, what are they teaching in schools about the Holocaust? Let us know. Find us again on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or again, you can email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, September 23rd. Sundial senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. By the way, the theme music that you hear for the program is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. Find them online, gopalo.com. And don't forget, look, if you missed the program or any parts of it, you can hear it again at 8 o'clock tonight, or you can find the podcast. Just subscribe to the podcast. Find it on your podcast app. Subscribe to WLRN Sundial. And always give us a rating. Let us know what you think. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, thousands of leaked documents show that billions of dollars from drug cartels and organized crime syndicates have been funneled into some of the world's most powerful banks. And as the saying goes, there's always a Miami connection. We're going to speak with the investigative reporters from McClatchy and El Nuevo Herald about the leak. Plus, 11th Circuit Court Judge Barbara Lagoa has a long history in Miami law, gaining prominence during the trial of Elian Gonzalez back in 2000. She's on President Trump's shortlist to replace the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And finally, have you heard the term? I know you have, right? Latinx? We have a panel conversation about what it means to be Latinx and take some of your questions. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. By the way, I'm off, but your host will be Tim Padgett. So, you know, he's got it covered. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thank you so much for listening. And as I say, be safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.